Today is April the 7th, 2021. Welcome to the award-winning Personal Computer Show. I'm Hank Key and my colleague is Joe King. Do you know who has your personal data? Do you know how Facebook, Google, Amazon, and other big tech companies are using your personal data? Our website is pcradioshow.org. We are heard each Wednesday at 6 p.m. Eastern Time on prn.fm, streaming on the internet. Podcasts of the program is available on prn.fm on the internet. You can leave us a message with your question or comment at hank@pcradioshow.org. LG is quitting the smartphone business. It's the end of an era. LG is exiting the smartphone business. LG said the decision will enable the company to focus resources in growth areas such as electric vehicle components, connected devices, smart homes, robotics, artificial intelligence, and business-to-business solutions, as well as platforms and services. Existing phones will remain on sale, and LG says it'll continue to support its products for a period of time, which will vary by region. The company hasn't said anything about possible layoffs, except that details related to employment will be determined at the local level. LG says it expects to have completed the business closure by the end of July this year. The move has been rumored for several months, following the division's huge losses over the past 5 years. Once considered a rival to fellow South Korean manufacturer Samsung, LG's recent high-end smartphones have struggled to compete, while its more affordable handsets has faced stiff competition from Chinese rivals. The company had previously said it hoped to make its smartphone division profitable in 2021. This news means LG's long-teased rollable phone is unlikely to ever see the light of day. The last time the company showed off the device was back at this year's virtual CES when the company insisted that the device was real and would be launching later this year. An attempt to sell the division reportedly failed. Reports that LG had been considering exiting smartphones has been around since at least the beginning of this year. An LG official later confirmed to the Korea Herald that the company had to make a cold judgment about the division. Potential measures could include sale, withdrawal, and downsizing of the smartphone business. In March, reports emerged that the company had tried to find a buyer for its smartphone business, but that talks had stalled and it could instead shut down the division. The company had ceased development of its upcoming phones with rollable displays and that it had shelved its planned smartphones for the first half of this year. LG joins a long list of high-profile device makers to give up on smartphones over the years. Although many of the brand names have stuck around on devices made by third-party manufacturers, Nokia's consumer-facing brand lives atop handsets made by HMD, while BlackBerry's branding was initially used by TCL and is set to return this year on a device made by Onward Mobility. There's also HTC, which still sells a few oddball handsets but sold most of its intellectual property to Google back in 2017. Who's next? Critical vulnerability affects Bluetooth-enabled cameras. A newly discovered vulnerability in the 4.x Bluetooth wireless standard has been shown to affect cameras that implement full remote control functionality. Demonstrated as viable in proof of concept laboratory testing, researchers believe that the exploit has the potential to either physically damage cameras or render them inoperable. The Bluetooth standard is a wireless technology for data exchange over short distances. While there is some overlap to the Wi-Fi standard, the latter is intended for networking devices, while Bluetooth was originally viewed to replace the connection cable between a computer and a peripheral device. For this reason, Bluetooth is point-to-point, tends to operate over short range, and is low power. Implementation is also intended to be low cost. Version 1 of the Bluetooth standard dates back to 1999. It has undergone several iterations over its lifetime to its current version 5 status. These iterations have, in part, been intended to fix problems from the first release that resulted in interoperability and connectivity problems, as well as addition of new features. In particular, researchers in the Department of Electrical Engineering at the Berlin Technical Institute, that is BTI, have focused upon the Bluetooth 4.1 specification, which introduced new mobile wireless service coexistence signaling to minimize interference, accelerate initial handshaking, and allow handoff between different Bluetooth services connected to a device. It is the last of these three adaptations that is open to exploitation on older devices running open source device drivers. Researchers in an unpatched environment can demonstrate a break in the chain of authentication, which allows the execution of unsigned code on the remote device. The laboratory has demonstrated the ability to either partially or fully overwrite the firmware in a remotely connected camera, altering its functionality or rendering it inoperable. The exploit has only been demonstrated in an experimental environment and requires a specific suite of conditions in order to occur. Specifically, older camera firmware that has implemented open-source Bluetooth drivers adhering to the 4.1 standard in combination with a device such as a PC, smartphone, or tablet that is also running an open-source driver stack. New Windows 10 update could finally fix a huge problem with drivers. A major Windows 10 update coming later in 2021 could finally fix a big problem with the operating system, as it will move third-party drivers to an isolated folder on your hard drive or your solid-state device. This is quite an important move. Drivers are incredibly important bits of software that allow Windows 10 to communicate with the hardware installed in your PC. Keeping drivers updated is essential to having a PC that runs well, but installing the wrong driver, or if a driver is released with a serious bug, can have serious effects on your PC, including system crashes and reduced performance. At the moment, all drivers are kept in the driver store folder, which resides under System 32 folder. This is a critical folder that shouldn't be messed around with, so storing third-party drivers there can be asking for trouble. A Windows latest reports with the upcoming Windows 10 21H2, in other words, in the second half of this year, Sun Valley update, third-party drivers look set to be moved from System 32 to an OEM drivers folder instead. And this change is already visible in early preview versions of Windows 10 21H2. By keeping the drivers away from the critical System 32 folder, the security of people's PCs should be greatly improved. There could also be some performance benefits as well for people who regularly upgrade their drivers, as it stops the System 32 folder from getting bloated. Hopefully, it should also result in a more stable system, as any faulty drivers will be isolated from important files. Could this mean we see a reduction in the dreaded blue screen of death in Windows 10? Who knows? If you ever had your PC crash on your system, or something stops working correctly in Windows 10, a driver problem could have been the culprit. So any move on Microsoft's part to limit this happening is certainly welcome. Selfies have become a mainstay of popular culture. Well, what does that say about the pictures we take? We use selfies for a variety of purposes. 82% of U.S. adults under the age of 34 had posted a selfie on social media. The last 4 years have seen the phenomenon begin to receive attention within the cognitive sciences. As recent studies have shown, the way we take selfies and the specific camera angles we choose varies depending on what we intend to do with them. Since the 1970s, we have known that in historical Western portraiture, artists favored depicting the left cheek of their sitters, particularly when painting women. A 2017 study showed that when it comes to taking selfies, people tend to angle their smartphone in order to photograph their own left cheek too. Recent evidence provides a clearer reason why this might be. The left side of the face is controlled by the right hemisphere of the brain, which in turn is responsible for communicating emotions. Thus, the left side is the more emotionally expressive. It might be that we simply find the left side more attractive than the right. In selfies, both left and right-handed people show the same left cheek bias, so here too, it's not about handiness. Instead, this prevalence suggests that we know instinctively that showing our left side is the better option. Patterns have also been detected in the way selfie takers position their cameras vertically. Another 2017 study of selfies that was analyzed determined that men taking selfies from below was partly out of an attempt to appear taller and therefore more masculine. Women taking selfies from above, meanwhile, were said to achieve the opposite and make them look shorter and more feminine. These differences in camera position creates different kinds of selfie. The question is, why? But how do these choices relate to what the selfies are being used for and the platforms they're posted on? Research has looked at the early trends in selfie poses and how some were about angling and composing your face so as to look thinner and more vulnerable, which is also equated with being more attractive. Researchers have also found that we tend to perceive ourselves as more attractive and likable in our selfies than in photographs other people take of us. The degree that we express ourselves depends on what we intend to communicate and the platform we're communicating on. By showing the left cheek or shooting from above, we look more expressive. Placing the camera frontally, meanwhile, achieves a neutral look. Google wins Java dispute. The Supreme Court has ruled in a 6-2 decision that Google's use of Java in Android represents fair use and does not infringe on Oracle's patents and copyrights. In a case that went back and forth for more than a decade, the U.S. Supreme Court has sided with Google in the dispute with Oracle over Google's use of Java code in Android. The top court decided by a 6-2 vote that Google's copying of a small fraction of the Java API did not infringe on Oracle's copyrights, but represented fair use. Nevertheless, Oracle still maintains that Google acted improperly. Google's copying of the Java Standard Edition API, which included lines of code to allow programmers to work in a new and transformative program, was a fair use of that material. The court's decreed in the ruling issued April 5, 2021. The fact that computer programs are primarily functional makes it difficult to apply traditional copyright concepts in the technological world, the court said. Arguments in the case had been heard October 7 of last year. In a statement in response to the ruling, Oracle remained adamant that Google misused, even stole Java. I can go on with this, but they lost in court and they're not taking it lightly. Ruling with a majority in the court case were Justices Stephen Breyer, John Roberts, Sonia Sotomayor, Elena Kagan, Neil Gorsuch, and Brett Kavanaugh. Justices Clarence Thomas and Thomas Alito dissented. Supreme Court Justice Amy Coney Barrett, who joined the court in late October, did not participate in the deliberations. In the ruling, the court said Google copied roughly 11,500 lines of code from Java Standard Edition, specifically from the Java API, to work with Android. But that was just 0.4% of the entire API at issue out of 2.86 million lines of code. Shortly after acquiring Java founder Sun Microsystems in 2010, Oracle filed a lawsuit against Google, alleging that Google's Android software infringed Oracle's patents and copyrights. Oracle sought remedies for the alleged infringement. The case finally made its way to the Supreme Court, and the lower courts had found for Google, while a U.S. Court of Appeals reversed the decision. This is the final decision that was made. Google won, Oracle lost. Let's move on. The headline news was that IBM's first retail quantum computer in the United States is headed to the Cleveland Clinic. Quantum computing will be used to explore genomics as well as for chemical and drug discovery. IBM Q System 1 is a 53-qubit quantum computer. IBM last week announced a 10-year partnership with Cleveland Clinic to develop the Discovery Accelerator, a lab that will research healthcare and life sciences using quantum computing and artificial intelligence. As part of the partnership, IBM will install its first-ever private sector IBM Quantum Computer System 1 in the United States at the clinic campus in Cleveland. The quantum computer will help transform medicine, said Dr. Tom Mihaljevic, CEO of Cleveland Clinic, said in a statement. These new computing technologies can help revolutionize discovery in the life sciences. Some of the research will look at genomics, chemical and drug discovery, single-cell transcriptomics, those are big words, population health and clinical applications, and researchers will also look at protecting privacy while using big data to improve patient care and responses to the global health crisis such as COVID-19. IBM said it will install its first next-generation 1,000-plus qubit quantum system at a client facility in Cleveland in the next few years. IBM last month unveiled improvements to quantum computing software that is said will increase performance by 100 times. Quantum computing is at its early stages of implementation. It is not ready for prime time, and it is not replacing the classical computer. But the fact that IBM is retailing the item means it is now out of the lab and it is being sold and used in specific applications. So let's start off by asking the question, what is a quantum computer? In 1998, Isaac Chung of the Los Alamos National Laboratory, Neil Gershenfeld of MIT, and Mark Kubinek of the University of California at Berkeley created the first quantum computer 2-qubit that could be loaded with data and output a solution. Quantum computing is an area of computing focused on developing computer technology based on the principles of quantum theory, which explains the behavior of energy on the atomic and subatomic levels. Classical computers that we use today can only encode information in bits that take the value of 1 or 0. Quantum computers perform calculations based on the probability of an object state before it's measured, instead of just ones or zeros, which means they have the potential to process exponentially more data compared to classical computers. A single state, such as on or off, up or down, one or zero, is called a bit. Well, what's the difference between a quantum computer and a regular computer? Quantum computers process information in a fundamentally different way to classical computers. Instead of relying on transistors, which can only represent either the one or the zero of binary information at a single time, quantum computers use qubits, which can represent both zero and one simultaneously. Instead of black and white, there's a gray area, and the gray area have many different shades, so you actually have many more values. Quantum computing is said to be more power efficient. They are expected to reduce power consumption from 100 to 1,000 times. Quantum computers could speed up the learning process of artificial intelligence, reducing thousands of years of learning to mere seconds. What can a quantum computer do that a classical computer can't? Factoring large numbers, for starters. Multiplying two large numbers is easy for any computer, but calculating the factors of a very large, say 500-digit number, on the other hand, is considered impossible or impractical on a classical computer. What kind of problems are quantum computers good at? Encryption and cybersecurity. These are probably the most known kind of problems that quantum computers can solve. For example, the complex mathematical problem that is the core of the design of RSA encryption and other public key encryption schemes is factoring a product of two prime numbers. Quantum computers are not magical. They may seem magical, because we know very little about it, but just because the fundamental math and physics behind them are somewhat complicated, the truth is a quantum computer is marginally better than classical computers, nothing more. Classical computers are better at some tasks than quantum computers, such as sending and receiving emails, creating spreadsheets and other documents, and desktop publishing. Quantum computers are not meant to replace classical computers. They're just meant to solve distinct problems that those solvable by classical computers. That being said, any problem that is impossible to solve using classical computers will be equally impossible to solve using quantum computers. So you're probably saying, if they only solve problems solvable on classical computers, then what's all the hype about? Well, quantum computers have the potential to solve some problems better, faster, and more efficient than classical computers. There are four types of problems that quantum computers can solve much better than classical computers: encryption and cybersecurity, chemistry research, optimization problems, and data analysis. Quantum computers can complete complex calculations in only seconds, the same calculations that would take today's computers thousands of years to resolve. They will also enable organizations to sample large amounts of information to analyze and optimize them. Moreover, quantum computers allow for quick detection, integration, and diagnosis from scattered data sets. They can search extensive unsorted data sets to quickly and uncover patterns. An example of that is Grover's search algorithm. All of that will transform the way we perceive and handle data and allow us to grow bigger and better. Quantum computers have a fascinating premise in solving some of the problems that classical computers failed to resolve. The quantum computer is not replacing the classical computer. It's not for the consumer level today, but tomorrow it may. Just remember, 50 years ago, only big corporations can have computers. Today, personal computing is for everyone. Do you still use a device with a mechanical hard drive in it? Flash storage has become so cheap and ubiquitous that outside of backup systems and network-attached systems, solid-state drives and flash memory now hold the data on most of our devices. Hard drive shipments peaked back in 2015, and fewer now are sold every year. But in terms of terabytes sold, hard drives are more important than ever. With web storage and backups, we're dumping more of our data into the cloud. And add in the artificial intelligence and big data, and global server capacity is increasing faster than ever. Flash is making inroads in servers, but physical hard disk storage still form the backbone of data farms. Larger drives have a lot of advantages for server operators. A bigger disk has greater areal density, which is how much data is stored per square inch, which can improve disk speed, and swapping larger disks into an existing system is almost always a cheaper way to boost capacity than building out new server racks. Disk capacity has continued to grow steadily, but with the recent 16-terabyte and 18-terabyte drives, we're approaching the limits of conventional technology. It works like this. Hard drives store data by changing the polarity of magnetic bits on the drive platter. Essentially, they write data by changing these bits so magnetic north is pointing either up or down. These bits are arranged into concentric rings called tracks. You can increase the storage capacity of a hard drive in a few ways. Add more disk, which is called platters, add more tracks per platters, or make the bits smaller, which is to increase the bits per track. Each of these have a few problems, though. For one, we're just out of space to add platters. An 18-terabyte drive may be cramming 9 platters into a standard hard drive enclosure. Adding more bits or tracks have their own problems, too. To make either smaller, you also need to shrink the write head. If the head is too much larger than the track or the bits, you're liable to accidentally overwrite neighboring bits when you try to write, like trying to use giant marker to write on narrow line paper. You can shrink the write head, but this makes it harder to generate the magnetic field needed to write data. You can cope with this by changing the platter material. By lowering its coercivity, or how resistant it is to outside magnetic fields. But this introduces a new problem. At the scale of nanoparticles, like those on a hard drive, materials with low coercivity have a tendency to randomly flip their magnetic polarity. That's not good if you want a reliable long-term data storage. The solution, however, may be two new techniques now called microwave and heat-assisted magnetic recording, or with the acronym MAMR and HAMR. These use an energy source, either a microwave-generating device called a spin-torque oscillator, or a laser, or change the platter material coercivity. This, coupled with a more stable platter material and a smaller write head, lets you pack more data onto each platter. Toshiba just shipped the first MAMR drive, an 18-terabyte model, earlier this month, and MAMR drives from Western Digital are expected shortly. Seagate has a 20-terabyte drive out to enterprise partners, and we may get consumer versions of those as well. It's still early days with both of these bits of technology, but drives made with these methods, collectively called energy-assisted magnetic recording, EAMR, should enable drives up to 60 terabytes and possibly beyond. Add other changes like dual-actuator designs that could double read speeds, and hard drives could see huge improvements in the next few years. No, the hard disk drive is still with us, and because its capability to have very high capacity, and with all that cloud computing, it'll be around. Presenting Benjamin Rockwell with his IT Pro Series, Applicant Tracking System Additional Thoughts.
This is Benjamin Rockwell, and now it's time to get down to business. It's time for us to take a look at the work world and technology. And actually, this week, I want to take a look back at something we just talked about a month ago. I talked about Applicant Tracking Systems, ATS. Now, these Applicant Tracking Systems are ways for people to, on the employer side, to scan through 1,000 resumes and find the right person for the job. Now, part of this is kind of messed up. Part of this applicant tracking system is fouled when you go through and you custom write your resume specifically utilizing all of the various keywords that they utilize. The problem is, doing that will lift you up higher, closer to what they want, maybe even perfectly for what they want. However, if you adjust some of your statements and you stray away from who you really are, you pad your resume, then you can actually wind up in a job that you're going to be miserable at, or you're going to be not successful at. And this has created an entire world of problems for employers and employees. Yes, because people rise to the top of these resume trackers. Oh, this is the perfect guy. He's got all of the right, different things in his resume. This is the absolute perfect woman for the job, whatever it is. But then they find out, well, you don't actually know this software. You put it on your resume because you knew it would hit and it would be fine. You may have put it on your resume and put it in white text. Well, they've solved that by making the actual resume into plain text. But there's all manner of these different hidden things which they put in there, which will, trip you up. So don't be adjusting your resume too far. Be honest with your resume. That's the best way to take advantage of applicant tracking, is to be honest. Yes, you can shift a few words. Don't rewrite your entire resume. But I also want to make you aware of another problem, and that is that some employers place out job openings that are so highly specific in their qualifications that they actually match up perfectly with one particular person. And they do this specifically so that that person can get a promotion or a lateral promotion. I've heard of this happening in a number of different organizations. Here, let me have your resume. Great. I want you to write your job, your job position based off of your resume. We want to build this up. All right, there we go. And yes, you'll get a raise, or you'll get you'll wind up getting revalidated, or whatever else it is. You know, there's another one too, which is there are companies that will match up resumes specifically with their current staff just to see if you are job hunting. Yes, that's been done too. So, yeah, there's all kinds of different things. There's all kinds of different processes that they do. Government jobs, that's a tricky area because they do that all the time. Hey, let's get Joe's resume. Okay, Joe's getting a promotion. All he has to do is apply for this promotion, and here is the job description, and it matches his resume, whatever it is. So this is a world that is getting very tricky. I do strongly suggest that if you are in the job market, we're no longer able to really compete. If you've got a higher level job than, let's say, $50,000 a year, and for some people they may say, is that all? And for some people they may say, oh, wow, that's a lot. But it doesn't matter. If your job is over $50,000 a year, I want you to get a professional resume writer. I want you to plunk down the cash, and I want you to pay for them to update your resume for these automated tracking systems, these applicant tracking systems, because they're going to know the optimal way to set this all up. And there are a number of different folks out there that do this professionally. You want to find one which has a lot of experience. You want to find one that is really, you know, a winner in the entire resume world. Don't just pay somebody $100 for this or $200. You want to find somebody who's a resume coach. They are an executive coach. They're somebody who's guiding people towards a better job. They're a leader. And you want to get some good feelings off of them that they're doing something more for you than just rearranging a few words, that they're doing more than just revamping your resume into a different style. You want somebody who's going to talk with you, get an idea of who you are, what makes you tick in the job world, in the computer world, in the technology world, or the secretary world, or the medical world. Whatever kind of job you have, they want to make sure that you are going to get the job that works the best for you. This is Benjamin Rockwell. Back to you, Hank.
Thank you, Benjamin. Computer pundits, and we have many of them, have announced regularly and forever predicting that mainframes would soon be extinct. Yet nobody told the mainframes, which remains alive and well, the backbone of world banking and other business systems. Reliable and secure, mainframes are seldom in the limelight, but one probably approved your last ATM withdrawal or reserved your last airplane ticket. In a large corporation, computing is with a mainframe computer. This differs with computers used in small or medium-sized business and the home or the personal computer. A mainframe computer, informally called a mainframe or big iron, is a computer used primarily by large organizations for critical applications, bulk data processing, such as the census and industry and consumer statistics, enterprise resource planning, and large-scale transaction processing. A single mainframe may execute the equivalent of 10 to 100 even more distributed processes worth of business activity. The vast majority of mainframe computers have provided continuous service measured in years and, in many instances, decades of nonstop functionality. Mainframes are a type of computers which are made for throughput as fast as possible. A throughput can be defined as the rate at which the data is processed, and also mainframes are used for transaction processing. A transaction can be defined as a set of operations, including disk read and write, operating system calls, transferring data from one subsystem to another. The major engineering feature of the modern mainframe computer that delivers is their considerable amount of redundant internal engineering. This is what gives mainframe computers their high reliability, tight security, extensive input-output facilities, strict backwards compatibility for older software, and high utilization rates, very little processing idle time, to support their characteristic massive throughput capabilities. And by the way, there's one big feature that used to be on personal computers that only is now retained on the mainframe architecture, and that is memory parity. In order for a mainframe computer to operate nonstop, that's to run for many years without interruption, all repairs and hardware upgrades can and do take place during the normal operation of the mainframe computer. Once again, this is another benefit that the inclusion of internal redundant hardware engineering makes possible. We have a tendency to have one size fit all when we buy things. In computing, there are different platforms for different processing needs. Form follows function. The mainframe industry is alive and thriving. Mainframes are still going strong after 70 years. Mainframes entered the market in the early 1950s when IBM and the Sevens Wharfs, which was made up of Burroughs, Unisys, NCR, Control Data, Honeywell, GE, and RCA, created the computing age and competed for critical applications, sophisticated modeling, and large-scale transaction and workloads among the largest organizations. Over the past 70 years, compute power, storage, and networking have seen various waves of centralization and decentralization amidst each wave of disruptive technology adoption. As with each wave, pundits, analysts, and industry watchers have forecasted the death of the mainframe. Yet, the venerable mainframe has prevailed. As reported in the last quarter of 2020 update on mainframe usage, IBM shared the following statistical information on mainframe adoption. 67 of the Fortune 100 companies are using mainframes. 45 of the top 50 banks, 8 of the top 10 insurance, 8 of the top 10 telcos, 7 of the top 10 retailers, and 4 of the top 5 airlines are all using the mainframe. While it may be one thing to tout usage of a technology by which organizations continue to adopt a technology, IBM has grown usage as measured by millions of instructions per second, a method of calculating the raw speed used, by 350% over the past 10 years. Many chief information officers have an and strategy, not an or strategy, for hybrid cloud. The newest mainframes include the latest Fujitsu GS21 series announced in April of 2018, along with the Fujitsu software GSS21SX V20, which supports connections with open systems. In September of 2019, IBM launched the IBM Z15, showcasing key capabilities such as encryption anywhere, cloud-native development, and instant recovery. From many conversations with CIOs in healthcare, travel, financial services, and pharma, the mainframe continues to play a key role in their overall modernization strategies. For many of these organizations, they are working with public cloud vendors such as Amazon Web Services, Microsoft Azure, and Google Cloud, and Alibaba Cloud, while keeping their intense workloads on the mainframe for both cost and security reasons. In fact, many competitive industry leaders value a hybrid approach with cloud and mainframe as a trusted, efficient architecture for their enterprise organizations, delivering intense hybrid workloads from securely filing a healthcare claim, making life-saving prescriptions, booking travel, initiating a credit check, and reducing fraud in banking online. A hybrid approach enables top businesses to apply the right technologies to the right workloads to reduce their risk. Why? Elasticity. As the CIO of a Fortune 50 financial services entity noted, the security performance, reliability, and value equation of the mainframe gives us the confidence to continue with our hybrid approach. The cost of data movement and I/O costs would be punishingly expensive with our current public cloud contracts. Users can use one language to access open systems and open software through a set of common APIs and OS capabilities. Consequently, developers can use the same tools for the cloud and mainframe, enabling a broader set of developers and resources to work on both. The numbers show that this well within 94 of the top 100 IBM Z enterprises are running Linux on Z and able to modernize with the mainframe. In addition, a 2019 survey of mainframe professionals conducted by Forrester for IBM showed that nearly 90% of the professionals in enterprise computing careers agree the job market for their skill set is growing, and 75% believe there's a high demand for their skills in mainframe. The growth of mainframe adoption has come at the same time the public cloud has expanded. It is estimated that 20% of the world's workloads are now in the public cloud. As adoption continues, coexistence of mainframe, on-premises, and cloud deployment will continue for at least the next decade. In 2020, Deloitte survey also confirmed that mainframe usage continues to grow. 74% believe the mainframe has a long-term viability as a strategic platform for their organization. 91% identified expanding their mainframe footprints as a moderate or critical priority in the next 12 months, and 72% are planning upgrades to their mainframe in the next 3 years. The bottom line, while public cloud usage has gained ground, hybrid cloud approaches has become mainstream among top organizations. Many businesses and technology leaders have expanded and grown their existing investments in mainframe for their critical next-gen computing environments. In fact, businesses rely on both the cloud and mainframe to lead digital transformation efforts built on trust to achieve peace of mind with speed, security, versatility, elasticity, and scale on demand in a hybrid environment. As leaders move forward, they should focus on getting the most out of their cloud and mainframe investments to improve organizational return on investment. Modernizing on the mainframe can be done in concert with distributed and cloud platforms. Balancing out data gravity and I/O costs will determine which technology to place transactional processing and critical workloads. In the meantime, teams can easily use the same tools and standards, such as the open source across all platforms, including mainframe. Form always follows function, and tech decisions must match the business use case. Mainframe computers are projected to play not only a key role to decades to come, but also to expand its footprint in the overall technology and business strategy of leading organizations. It's been said that mainframes are dying and it will disappear like a dinosaur. Ain't gonna happen. Presenting Marty Winston with his All Hands on Tech, connecting the dots from Flickr to Liquor.
Sorry, this isn't the report on growing fleets of ray-beaming robots. That got delayed a couple weeks. This report is faster than the blink of an eye, but in sight of you right now. And one reason there's so much fatigue after a day's work. It's about something we've seen with every artificial lighting technology that's bright enough to read by. It's flicker. Depending on the technology, it may happen 60 or 120 times each second. And just to prove it, a videographer friend helped by shooting his garage light at 240 frames per second, four times faster than the flicker happens, and then bring the frame rate back down on playback in a mode you'll instantly recognize as slow motion. And what you can see is enough winking and blinking to make you nod, which is exactly the point. You may not have been on computers back when monitors had big old picture tubes, officially CRTs, that's short for cathode ray tubes, but the flickering on those was tiring. Do all lights always flicker? Almost all AC-powered lights do. Incandescent bulbs, you know, grandparent-style bulbs with filaments inside, the kind that can get not just warm but hot, those bulbs in lamps and fixtures flicker every time the AC voltage goes full high or full low. That's when they're bright, in between's when they're not. But incandescent bulbs and flashlights don't flicker. They get a steady DC voltage supply from the flashlight batteries, so they're a steadier source of light. At least until the battery's shot. Fluorescent lights also flicker. No need to get into filaments and ballasts and all that. They flicker. That videographer's garage light was an LED model with those aimable petals on it. A lot of people are surprised to learn that LEDs flicker. They may not connect directly to the AC power line, but the thing that powers them, called a driver, does connect that way, and most drivers pass along that flicker to the LED emitters themselves. By the way, many LED flashlights also flicker. They too have drivers, normally to help squeeze more light or more runtime or more illumination modes out of any given battery and emitter. So, lights flicker. So what? Here's where the trail begins, and it's a trail you've been on just about daily. That flickering happens too quickly for the mind to register. In a way, it's like watching movies or TV. Nothing really moves. You see a series of still images that can change a little bit from one to the next, and they appear 24 or 30 or 50 or 60 times per second. Your mind doesn't register them as still images. Your mind registers them as motion. And a lot like that, your mind registers flickering lights as steady lights. That's your mind, not your eyes. This is about all the changes to which your eye automatically adjusts. Changes in focus happen all the time, but at a speed much slower than dozens of times per second. Changes in brightness, on the other hand, involve the roughly 125 million photoreceptors. About 120 million of those are rods, the rest cones, and those are inside our eyes. Light hitting those photoreceptors prompt changes in membrane potential, which is how the signals of our vision accomplish, stand by, there's a very geeky term just ahead, it's how vision accomplishes visual phototransduction, which is how those images in your eyeballs make it to your brain. In a way, the eyeball is a biosensor array at the input to a nervous system's electronic brain connection. Electronic is misleading. Call it electrochemical. But the rods and cones, especially the rods, are processing light in an evolved version of the way plants sense light. Just as a plant may turn its leaves toward the sun by letting sunlight be the energy source for an electrochemical process, well, on a much more detailed scale and at higher speeds, that's largely how our vision works. So, back to those flickering lights. Remember, that flicker is far too speedy to result in detection and processing by the brain to the extent that it might send a signal to the eye muscles to change the size of the opening of the iris. But that doesn't mean that it has no effect. And, without getting into the nitty-gritty of it, there's a good chance that every one of you has experienced some of it. At the end of a morning, as you're ready to break for lunch, do you ever notice yourself feeling a little tired? On a Saturday, when you're working at home or out shopping or doing other non-office work, do you feel more tired than that or less tired than that by lunchtime? just before those breaks, perhaps as early as mid-morning or mid-afternoon. Do you have a slight headache?
A big headache?
When you break for lunch, or even more so when you get back home, do you find yourself irritable, short-tempered, or even just cranky? Beyond head throbs, have you noticed signs of stress? When you get home, do you ever wish you could just relax and have a drink, an adult beverage drink? For an astonishingly large number of people, you've just connected the dots between flicker and liquor. But let's test that hypothesis. For 1 week, work with the window shades and curtains open. Let sunlight in. Dim or turn off the electric lights if you can. And if that results in you being less fatigued, less headachy, less stressed, and less likely to reach for a bottle, ding, 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 you just connected those dots. If you have any say-so over your office lighting, you may want to investigate flicker-free lighting. That's a special UL certification. Not many lights have earned it, but do a search or ask a lighting contractor. Next time, computing has been taking some comparatively sharp turns away from the systems that are old and familiar to many of us, and into an age where our computing platforms can still be great performers with a lot less than before. Significantly less memory, significantly smaller onboard storage, considerably fewer add-on hardware items, and significantly better results in personal productivity. If there's a poster child for this new paradigm, it's the Microsoft Surface, but there's even more going on beneath the Surface than above it. Be here for our report, Surface Changes, and see if you can find sufficient satisfaction in the Surface's services.
Thank you, Marty. Public service announcements. Computer club meetings in New York, New Jersey, and Connecticut tri-state region. Most of the computer clubs have begun to schedule their general monthly meeting through teleconferencing. For updated information, visit the website of the computer club. New York Amateur Computer Club has a meeting on Thursday, April the 8th at 7 p.m. Topic of presentation is an update on hard disk drive and solid state drive technology for storage. Via Zoom virtual meeting, www.nyacc.org. The Long Island Macintosh Users Group meeting on Friday, April the 9th. Meeting time at 7 p.m. via Zoom virtual meeting. Their website is LIMAC. That's LIMAC.org. Brookdale Computer Users Group has a presentation on software for landing Perseverance on Mars. Thursday, April the 22nd. Meeting time is 6:45 p.m. via Zoom virtual meeting. Website is bcug.com. The Amateur Computer Club of New Jersey has a meeting on Friday, May the 7th. Meeting time is 8 p.m. via Jitsi Meet. Website is acgnj.org. The Westchester PC Users Group via Zoom virtual meeting, and their website is wpcug.org. Our website is pcradioshow.org. We are heard each Wednesday at 6 p.m. Eastern Time on prn.fm, streaming on the Internet. Podcasts of the program is available on prn.fm on the Internet. If you have any questions for us, just send us an email addressed to hank@pcradioshow.org. In the meantime, stay in touch and remember to do regular backups. I'm Hank Key, and on behalf of Joe King, Michael Horowitz, Marty Winston, and Benjamin Rockwell, we thank you for listening. Stay safe and healthy until we meet again, same time, same station next week.